the Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday, May 5th, 2005, and we're here today to continue the public hearing on House Bill 5030, which is the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Forestry, and also to do a public hearing on House Bill 5031, which is a fee bill for pile burns for the Oregon Department of Forestry. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5030, and Mr. Brown, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Marvin Brown, Director of the Department of Forestry. As we discussed yesterday, our goal is to stay under 45 minutes.
What I'd like to do is a slight change to the agenda. After we're finished discussing the budget detail, what I'd like to do is recess the public hearing on this bill and open a public hearing on the fee bill, have that public hearing, and then reopen the budget bill to take public testimony. So I'd like to have 45 minutes or so left over for public testimony. So as expeditiously as we can move through the presentation, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, that's our goal, Madam Chair. Well, it's been about 25 minutes on private lands with Ted, and hopefully about 10 minutes on urban forestry and about 10 minutes on ministry.
That would be great.
I'll turn it over to Ted.
Good afternoon.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee. I'm Ted Larson, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry, in charge of the Resource Policy Division, which includes the Private Lands Program. In terms of the Private Lands Program, there are a number of values that the program creates. Obviously, one is jobs and economic activity. Did want to provide some context there. Basically, at this point in time, private lands now provide most of the timber outputs in terms of Oregon's timber production. It's over 80%. In looking at that, per million board feet produced in Oregon, it provides for about 16 jobs and $68,000 in income tax revenue to the state of Oregon. And obviously, how we implement the private lands program can influence whether or not those outputs go up and down over time. We also protect a number of environmental amenities. For example, the major source of drinking water comes off of forest lands, and it's certainly where the highest quality water is in the state of Oregon. We provide for community viability, forest land regulatory stability through a number of ways, but principally what we found, as long as the public understands that forests are well protected, they accept management practices that are under the Forest Practices Act and conducted on private lands. We also provide value relative to federal regulation and ESA assurances. And in that regard, we've been doing a lot of work on the Oregon Coho assessment, particularly on the habitat section. And I think the output there is going to be very important in terms of trying to ensure that the federal agencies recognize the Oregon Plan and the Forest Practices Act as important contributors to federal regulation ESA assurances processes and their decision they'll make with listing the coastal coho salmon. We also provide support both in terms of regulatory stability and federal regulation by ensuring that a full range of science is considered in their processes, and also trying to help them understand that protection in the context of meeting our interest in applying ecological principles does not mean prevent change. And again, that's an important understanding that we bring forward to the federal processes that's sometimes missing from their approaches. We also provide value by meeting specific landowner objectives, and it was discussed yesterday about the range of interest and objectives that we see on private lands. Some landowners have a very strong emphasis on wood production, while others have a different set of emphases that we try and accommodate and support through a number of processes. In addition to those very specific objectives of the program, we also provide value by providing infrastructure in terms of fire overhead and fire prevention processes that were discussed yesterday. In terms of what the program does, we help the Board of Forestry develop and implement rules, policies, and procedures to carry out the Oregon Forest Practices Act. We provide a range of training and technical assistance to both landowners and operators. In that context, it includes also supporting some cost-share program implementation. We maintain and coordinate resource inventory information and share that with landowners and other parties to ensure that the Forest Practices Act is effectively implemented. We audit landowner and operator compliance. We investigate complaints and take appropriate enforcement action, which can include repairing any damage that does occur. We monitor program and rule effectiveness and have a very unique and effective program with regard to that that I'm particularly proud of. We assist forest landowners and selected watershed councils in implementation of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, provide a range of forest health surveys and technical assistance by monitoring insect and disease conditions throughout the state on an annual basis, and then provide on-the-ground service delivery through 57 stewardship foresters. And the map here shows the distribution of those foresters at this point in time, and be addressing some of the impacts to that distribution of those numbers under our budget a little later on. In terms of issues affecting program delivery, the funding system that we use to administer the reforestation tax credit was eliminated with the change in forest land tax systems in the last several years, and that funding runs out effective this June. A key budget issue is the use of federal salmon recovery funds in place of general fund, and there are several things that come out of that. You may have seen the letter that the governor received from NOAA Fisheries with regard to use of those funds, and it's always interesting to me how certain agencies target the Forest Practices Act, but the act was specifically mentioned in that letter, and certainly the use of those funds for administration of the act was a point of concern to them. Tied to that, very clearly, some of the debate we've had over the role of federal regulation and the role of the state in achieving that has caused us to be a target of third-party interest in the use of these funds, so we're somewhat concerned about that risk of people bringing some sort of a action with regard to using those funds for some of the existing program purposes. We've had a number of costs related to legal fees and some very challenging lawsuits, and the budget amounts for our legal fees are less than our expenditures at this point in time. Ballot Measure 37 creates another set of possibilities there. We've not yet had adequate funding to assess the landslide hazards that affect public safety. That was part of Senate Bill 12. Sudden oak death has become a major issue. We've taken a fairly aggressive approach to trying to eradicate that issue, and how we can maintain the infrastructure and funding to support that's an issue. We've seen some challenges in terms of outbreaks of bark beetle in eastern Oregon, and providing for adequate field personnel to provide assistance to support that and apply some federal cost share funds is somewhat limiting at this point in time. And then we've also lost some specific positions that have been directed for administration riparian protection standards that were supported through the 94 rule development process. This table shows our budget reductions. I'll kind of move right past that and talk about that later in terms of some of the impacts. In terms of the revenue sources, the Forest Practice Act has traditionally been funded in a split 60-40 between 40% harvest tax and 60% general fund. The way the statute's set up is the funding of harvest tax cannot exceed 40% of expenditures of the program in terms of the forest practices part. The budget has a shift from the 60% appropriation to the salmon restoration funds passed through OWEB. They're expressed as other fund dollars. The budget provides full funding for the insect and disease program in terms of the staffing support of that. And the federal funds provide a range of federal, our forest landowner technical assistance and financial assistance, and pay for the insect and disease monitoring and so far the mitigation efforts under the sod outbreak. We do receive other funds for carbon sequestration credits and tree planting under the underproducing forest lands and burning fees with regard to the smoke management program. I think we'll skip past this one too. We've had a number of budget reductions since 9901 that kind of address the tables we skipped over. During the 2001-03 regular session, we had several additions to address issues that were important in accomplishing some of the regulatory programs that were directed by the legislature. Riparian specialists were intended to provide expertise to help landowners implement the relatively more complex riparian protection rules and encourage active management and restoration of those areas. and the geotechnical specialists were added to implement the shared responsibility that was intended by the legislature with regard to landslides and public safety. Those were added in the regular session. During the special session, then there was a number of positions eliminated. You can read them for yourself, but it did then include eliminating the three riparian specialists and the two geotechnical specialists. More importantly, we had an elimination or reduction of 8 field stewardship foresters at that point in time. In the 03-05 reductions, we eliminated one program director through program consolidation, which gets to one of our key objectives, which is to implement a consolidated program. Again, talked about the replacement of the general fund with federal funds in the context of Pacifico Salmon Restoration Funds, and actually they are seen as other funds. And then we've got the smoke management fund shift, which is increasing use of burn fees to support the program as opposed to general funds. The governor's budget for 05-07 has additional three staff specialists reductions, one administrative person, and additional two stewardship foresters that would be eliminated in the budget. There are several policy packages. The first is a federal watersheds grants program, and that's actually part of the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, the federal program. Is for both one position to administer, it's called a watershed forester, and that program would help administer federal watershed grants if that program was authorized and funded, and so far it hasn't been. Smoke management fee increase, which would make permanent the use of the current fees that we have in place for managing smoke management, and is based upon the user pay approach. Reforestation tax credit is replacement funding for the EOSTOT and WestDOT funding of that program that ends this June. And with regard specific to that, we have been looking at that and believe there are some alternatives to what we proposed in the policy package, and we want to explore that with you as we go through the hearing process. And again, looking at the workload for that and other opportunities, we think there's some good chances to do things differently there that may be somewhat different than what we proposed here. Then the Cooperative Forestry Assistance POP is related to providing our ability to use other funds for support of both our seed orchard seed use, as well as integrated pest management, getting other fund services for that, using dollars to support that. The proposed budget has a reduction of 9.6 FTEs, of which I talked about, includes several stewardship forester positions. That is also tied to the industrial fire program reductions that were described in the fire program, and again, overall, that results in a fairly substantive impact on the number of positions around the state. There are some legislation that need to be considered with regard to our budget. Ballot Measure 37 and number of land use bills are out there. Several House and Senate bills have been introduced addressing a number of Ballot Measure 37 elements, and it's not clear whether those are going to have any legs or not, but ultimately, depending upon either result of that legislation or status quo, there's a significant amount of uncertainty, and to the degree that uncertainty remains unaddressed, we have some opportunity to generate a fair amount of DOJ expenses. Specific to that, we've had 5 claims so far, of which most have been along the lines of I want to change the use of my property as opposed to being something specific to forest practices.
Have the claims been adjudicated all the way through the system at this point?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, they have not. Our first staff report will have to be approved early June, and that will be the time period in which that will have to be approved by the Board of Forestry and acted on. That, interestingly enough, is a claim by Dorothy English relative to a land use change. And again, we've seen a fair number of those that are basically, I would like to do something, and the Forest Practices Act rules apply to my land, therefore, here's a claim. And I think those type of things will be relatively easy to deal with other than processing time. We do have at least one claim relative to a specific forest operation and landslide issues. There are two bills that have been introduced regarding authorizing the department to accept funds under forest legacy but not tied to budget authority. There is the 2729 House bill, which provides for community forestry authority, and we're not quite sure what role we would play there. There is a bill, Senate Bill 786, which addresses how the department would provide forestry seedlings in the future in terms of providing a more efficient and effective means with regard to that service in lieu of the state forest nursery process we have in place. And then House Bill 2122 sets the forest products harvest tax rates for 2006 and 07, given the forecasted increase in timber harvest as well as carryover and harvest tax. We would expect that rate, everything else being equal, to go down somewhat. So that's what we wanted to cover with regard to that.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Let's keep moving along here.
Good afternoon, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. My name is Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester, and I'll give you a brief overview of the Urban and Community Forestry Program. Basically, 79% of Oregonians live in Oregon cities and adjacent urban areas, and the focus of this program is to help Oregonians improve the quality of life by promoting community investment in our urban forests. And we do that basically through three primary approaches. We provide technical, financial, and educational assistance to the cities, and really help them deal with their green infrastructure. So often our cities focus on the roads and utilities, and they don't think about the trees that are associated with those. So to get the benefit out of those trees in terms of stormwater runoff, cooling effects, air pollutants, wildlife habitat, clean water, noise pollution, et cetera, there has to be some thought about how we manage that green infrastructure. To help them do that, we provide training to city employees and community leaders. In fact, we have a joint program with the state of Washington in which we train city employees to develop management programs, primarily those cities that don't have urban foresters. We provide leadership on a variety of issues that are interface issues that you mentioned, you heard yesterday in the protection program. Really, there is no fire doesn't know where the boundary is between the rural and urban areas, so we can deal with those issues by working collaboratively, such as defensible space issues. And also, we help communities solve urban natural resource management, including hazard tree and tree risk management issues. This is one of the highest rated issues among cities, is how to deal with hazard trees, because those tends to be where their problems are. And we've been working with several cities to provide FEMA grants to do proactive risk assessment and hazard tree identification so that they've been able to get ahead of the program a little bit instead of waiting for a storm.
What's the
cost of the program and what's the funding of it? The funding source to cover those programs.
The cost? Representative Krieger, the total cost of the program is about, it's all federal funds, and we've been about $500,000 to $600,000 per biennium, not including the grants and those sorts of things that we get through a variety of other sources. Just to give you an idea then on kind of what we're doing in terms of technical assist, and this is where we actually make an affirmative reach out and touch someone sort of approach with the cities. We've been pretty steadily increasing over time since the program increased, but in the last year, and I've just checked with our folks this year, 2004, we're up to 670 increases. So over the last couple of years, we've seen quite a bit of an increase in demand for our services. The program hasn't grown in size, but we are getting increased demand for services. On the next page, it's just an effort to show you that we do leverage whatever available money we can get from the federal government and other sources for grant programs. The grant programs are really important and to help the communities build capacity, and that's one of our key efforts, is to build capacity at the local community level so they have a viable infrastructure to deal with this issue. And all this is trying to show is that over the years we get a variety of different grants. The amount requested, as you might expect, typically exceeds the amount that we get. But the other important point is to notice that the amount we grant Generally speaking, the local match is about a 2-to-1 ratio. In other words, they have to come up with more money, at least as much money or more, than we're granting them, and they typically are able to do that. In fact, this last year it was about a 3-to-1 ratio. The next chart just gives you an idea of kind of what the technical assist and financial assistance has been able to do over time. When we look at the last 4 years, what I want to show you this chart is a couple of interesting. The first two blocks, I'll talk about the kind of pink shaded areas. What we've been able to do is kind of decrease the number of people that aren't participating at all in the program. And Oregon has about 240 cities. So about a quarter of those people don't participate. About 40 to 36% of the folks operate at a project level. And the project level is, you know, they got an idea, they get a project, but they really haven't built any infrastructure or anything like that to sustain a program. Next slide. The group that we're really excited about and the improvement we've seen about is basically the bottom half of that chart, because this is the group that's actively managing their urban forest resources. And as you can see, since 2001, we've been able to increase significantly the number of folks that are in the formative stage. In other words, they've made some real positive steps towards having a positive program. And also we have moved the folks that are in the developmental, which is the middle block, down into the sustainable programs. In other words, they've really built a program that's going to, with a little bit of help from us, is going to be able to continue on over time. Our goal is that 50% of the cities in Oregon will reach that level. The next slide just shows you that there's been an upward trend in Tree City USA. It's about 38% of the cities. And this gives you an idea of where those cities are located. While most of them are in the Willamette Valley, we're very excited about getting a number of rural communities involved in the program. And the last slide, just to show you that there are some program issues, basically it's just lack of understanding, urbanization, reducing canopy cover as we continue to grow within our urban growth boundaries. And then budget issues is basically it's federal funds, and that's decreasing. And the amount of funding basically limits our ability to reach out to the population.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and do the agency administration.
Can I ask a quick question?
I'm sorry.
Just very quickly.
Please.
This probably isn't a problem other places, but in Portland, as I live in the older part of the city, I see a lot of the parks that are very mature in terms of the trees. Mount Tabor Park, have you ever seen it? It's all old growth timber. What do you do as those cities come to you, ask for advice with regard to, you know, trees that are potentially aging and there's not much younger stuff planted? At some point in time, something has to give, I would assume.
Senator Shields, members of the committee, that's one of the issues you have with urban forestry is it gets into a lot of preservation, but they tend to think about the entire management of the forest, the urban forest. We were in Forest Park with the Board of Forestry, and that same issue was raised, in that we have a number of trees that were planted in Forest Park probably 80 to 100 years ago. And the ongoing need to replace those trees if we're to maintain that legacy that we were given that many years ago. So the question is, you know, where are the forest parks of the future? And you need to start those now if you want to have those kind of green infrastructure in the future. So the city has a program for managing urban forests. They have urban forestry staff.
And you do advise them and try to...
We work with them.
I see the talking that's going on. I don't see much change. I've been around Portland 30 years now, and I haven't seen much change in terms of, you know, younger trees being planted or whatever. Just wondering.
Sure. I can provide you. There has been an increase in canopy cover in the city of Portland. It has been a small increase, and I've got some information on that we can share with you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Good afternoon, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. I'm Mark Seeley. I'm the Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry, and I'll lead us through the agency administration support program information and then wrap up with you. The agency administration program was actually created by the legislature for the department in 1989 and brought together all of our administrative work across the agency into a single program. The values that we create within the program are both internal and external values relating to leadership of the organization, maintenance of the workforce, management of risk, dealing with accountability and trust, providing for an approach of open, transparent public involvement and understanding, building strong stakeholder relationships, doing our work based on credible and science-based information, and then providing internal service to the department. As is the case in most state agencies, our program components include the business services of the agency, as well as human resources and information technology. We also consider, under the umbrella of agency administration, the agency leadership, our quality assurance program, agency affairs, the planning work that our resource planning staff does, and then the kind of single service internal focused efforts in equipment pool, capital improvement and construction, facilities management, and debt service. We utilize performance measures for the program in a number of ways. One of the ways is to begin to utilize two of the new performance measures that we have proposed to you for the next biennium. In addition, Department of Administrative Services is working with all state agencies to create a consistent set of administrative performance measures, and again, in the areas of human resources, information systems, and business services, and we'll be utilizing those same broad across state government measures. And then as we work on our quality assurance program, we'll also be creating measures for risk and accountability. Just a few of the issues, major issues that affect our agency administration cost and value delivery. And if you look down this list of items, I think what you would see and what I would talk to today is to kind of lump them into three major categories. One is our human resource, our employee base, and that asset. The next are our financial assets and our business systems that go along with that. And the third is the cost of doing business today as a state agency. And so let me touch briefly on each of those. The first two bullets really talk about the people side. Like most organizations today, public and private, we are experiencing and going through a significant turnover of staff related to the baby boom generation and retirements. For us, it really started kind of in earnest about 5 years ago. We began planning for this about 8 years ago, and we think we're kind of in the mid-cycle right now with another 6 to 8 years of more than average turnover of employees based on retirement. In fact, our current projections show us that about 50% of our permanent employees will be retiring, or eligible to retire, I should say, in the next 6 to 8 years. Just as an example of that, Ted just shared with you the number of stewardship foresters across the state, 57 stewardship foresters. We've actually had a change of 22 of those 57 positions with new people just in the last 2 years. Now, not all of that is due to retirement, but most of it was, and so that gives you a sense of the kind of change that we're dealing with. Along with that is our ability to continue to build and maintain our capacity in our workforce, a quality workforce and a diverse workforce. On the second component relating to business systems and the work that we do.
Madam Chair.
Senator Schultz.
Can I back up just a second before you jump out of this retirement mode stuff? I'm sure it represents challenges. It probably also represents some opportunities in terms of diversity. How's the department doing therein?
Here, Morgan, Senator Shields, it does, and you're exactly right. In fact, it relates and connects with that second bullet. Our plan, our diversity plan, and what we do specifically with respect to the state's affirmative action plan, again, is one that's kind of built today on the succession issue, because we know that we've got significant turnover. I think I would say that in our professional series of classifications, particularly in the forester and technical professional series, we're gaining ground, but we're not at parity at this point. in a very broad brush, we consider parity in that series to be 25% of our workforce in those technical and professional series of protected class employees. We're currently at about 15% today. We've made gains, but continue to need to do additional work there.
But you're working at it.
Yes. And we've got a number, in fact, our material with you today, the notebook material, gives you a summary of our overall affirmative action and diversity plan. We've got a number of pieces of that that do relate to the technical and professional series, all the way from working with colleges and universities and natural resources to maintain our connection with them for recruiting, even our intern recruiting, before they become permanent employees so that we can move on forward.
Madam Chair, that last piece especially is heartening to me, because if they're in active communication with the university system to recruit, then they're going to have a better chance of meeting their diversity goals. So that's really good stuff.
Thank you. Again, the second area of concern for us in terms of issues for the program does relate to our ability to provide both cost-effective business work in the agency, as well as accountable and credible information. We're currently working with systems that range anywhere from a few years to up to 30 years in age in terms of our business processes and systems. And we really need to move forward with some improvements. We began work on some initial scoping and planning this biennium, and have some hopes to be able to do additional work next biennium. But that will take some resources, and it will take additional resources beyond what we have today in our budgets. We did propose some concepts in the agency request, and because of the general fund constraints, those were not carried forward, but that is important. And then the third element is simply the cost of doing business. And in state government today, whether it's cost related to perks and employee benefits, or whether it's cost related to risk management, we've seen some significant cost increases in the last 2 years, and those costs will be with us for the future. Very concerned about that. Certainly, the general fund component is important to all of us, but the other fund component, whether it come from private forest landowner assessments or whether it come from state forest revenues, is also of concern to us. The Forestry Business Improvement Initiative that I mentioned earlier in terms of our business system is described on the next slide. I won't go into any more information there. You've got a greater detail within the notebook material. I'll go ahead and skip to slide 86, and this gives you a snapshot of the budget reductions that have been a part of our work in agency administration since 1909-01. We took significant reductions in the 03-05 budget process, really as an outcome and an outfall of the 01-03 special session effort. And then the governor's recommended budget for 05-07 includes an additional 3.3 FTE of reductions in the program. So with that, I think I'll stop on agency administration, and we just have two final summary slides that we share with you today, and the first is just a slide that puts in one place the governor's recommended budget policy packages that you've heard about, a total in terms of dollars of $8 million. Of which $4 million approximately are federal funds, $3.7 million other funds, and $196,000 of general fund. And then the final slide gives you just a current status of our performance measure work with you. Following our phase one hearing, we worked with Legislative Fiscal Office and Budget Management, made some refinements to our performance measures. You'll recall that we were also in transition and from our old system and old set of measures to a new proposed set for 05-07. We think we're now ready to solidify those with you during work session. Be glad to talk about those in further detail if you'd like, but again, we can talk in some more detail in work session. We now have 21 proposed measures, and we added a customer service measure and also refined two fire measures, one dealing with fire operations and the other with firefighter safety.
Questions or comments from the members of the committee? Let's proceed. That's it?
That's it.
What I'll do now is recess the public hearing on House Bill 5030 and open a public hearing on House Bill 5031, which is the fee bill.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I'm Tim Keith, Assistant State Forester in charge of the Forest Protection Division. You should have in front of you the testimony for 5031. 5031 permanently raises the fees that we collect for the burning of piled forest fuels under the smoke management plan.
Slide 63 is what I've got.
Is that this one?
No, I have it.
In the same book?
63
is where it is.
Please proceed to.
Thank you, and we did flip back to slide 63 because that kind of is an overview of House Bill 5031. But it does raise the fees permanently from $2 per acre for pile burns to $5 per acre for pile burns. During the last legislature, due to the general fund shortfall, nearly all of our general fund money was removed from the smoke management program, but in doing so, the legislature supported the approach of replacing general fund resources with fee revenue. So the state forester and board of forestry, with existing statutory authority to adopt rules pertaining to registration and fees, adopted a fee increase to backfill those reductions. That was done in late 2003, and then the fee increase took place in January 2004. During the hearing process for the fee increases, we received three comments, one from the Oregon Forest Industries Council on behalf of the Industrial Forest Landowner Community, and the second from the Bend Clean Air Committee, both supporting the fee increase. One person did object to the increase. At the same time, through the biennium, we were reviewing the smoke management plan with an appointed public review committee, and in their deliberations, they are supporting the need to adequately fund the smoke management program. Their report will be given to the Board of Forestry for further action and deliberation in June. During the past biennium, I think it's important to note that we didn't add any positions as a result of this fee increase, nor are we proposing any for 2005-2007, but rather the fee increase is simply to help fund the staff we currently have. House Bill 5031, to conclude, is necessary because ORS 291-055 requires us, state agencies, to seek legislative approval for fee increases that occurred during the past biennium. So that's why we're here before you today, and we urge your support.
Questions or comments?
I didn't look in here real close. What do you anticipate it's going to raise in revenue?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, it raised it, of course, from $2 to $5. We're already bringing that revenue in. I don't have the specific number with me. Bill, do you have
that? Mr. Lafferty.
My name is Bill Lafferty. I'm the Fire Program Director for the department. Of course, burning is dependent on the weather, and so the revenues associated will fluctuate, but for 2004 so far, we've collected $128,000 additional revenue. Had it been $2 an acre, we'd have collected that much less. So it's going to be adequate to fund the program that we have in place, assuming traditional levels of burning continue.
Any questions or comments? If Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5031, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 5030 and go into public testimony. I will call forward Bart Starker and Bud Henderson. Thank you so much for joining us.
Certainly. Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I'm Bart Starker. I'm from Starker Forest in Corvallis, and also am president of the West Oregon Protective Association and also a member of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee of the state. I'm here to support the Department of Forestry's general fund budget. And I'm going to be very general in my comments because we have several more people behind me that are very specific.
I forgot to announce one thing, so I'm going to break in here, too, that we would take comments on both of the bills at the same time. So anyone that wants to testify on House Bill 5030 and 5031 should feel very comfortable to do it when they're sitting in front of us.
We have several people lined up here to speak to the specifics of the fire protection budget, but I want to primarily talk about the uniqueness of the Oregon system and how it's and the part that the general fund plays in that uniqueness. We've got a system that's been in place now for most of this century. It started in the early part of the century, 1904 or 1902, somewhere in the early part of the century, and was based on a shared responsibility of fire protection being both a general public responsibility as well as a landowner responsibility. And that's unique in Western states. We've gone back and forth. Various percentages of the shared responsibility is fluctuated over time with general fund shortfalls and that sort of thing, but it's hovered around 50% in each case. But it's varied a little bit. It's based on the fact that it's a collaborative participatory kind of a system, and we want to create ownership of the general public and the landowners in the process of fire protection. Landowners are very proud of the system we have here in Oregon and very protective of it. And we have ownership in it because we participate in it on an annual basis. We have public and private interests at risk here. Of course, the public has public safety and wildlife habitat and stream quality, water quality, and all those kind of values that are certainly at risk through wildfire efforts. And of course, the private companies private landowners have their risks in their crop and their land investments in the land, as well as their we like green forests rather than red forests. And I guess there's a bigger underlying thing that we all have in common, and that is it's the foundation of our forestry investments. You can't justify investing in forest land if you can't have some assurance that it's not going to burn up in a year or two. It's just the primary building block or foundation of that forestry investment. One thing I wanted to touch on that is a little bit more specific is severity funding. I think, do all of you familiar with what severity funding is, so I don't have to define that for you?
Discussion about it yesterday with
okay,
the department.
Good. It's needed because we budget
and the whole system is built on kind of budgeting for the average worst or average bad fire season. And when you have an unusual occurrence around the state, we need to be able to react to that and beef up our system in that particular part of the state that has that predicted occurrence, weather occurrence or fuel occurrence or whatever the hazard might be. And we haven't traditionally had that ability to do that, and it's proven to be very, very effective over the last several years. And I'm speaking now from my experience with the Emergency Fire Cost Committee. It's just saved a tremendous amount of resources, both from the Emergency Fire Cost Committee and the General Fund, I think, in having that ability to react and beef up our system where it needed to be during those kind of occurrences. So I would certainly urge you to both generally fully fund the General Fund share of the Cooperative Fire Protection System and reinstate from what was in the governor's budget the severity funding. Thank you.
Mr. Henderson.
Chair Morgan, committee members. My name is Bud Henderson. I'm a forester for Hampton Affiliates, and I'm the current president of the Northwest Oregon Forest Protective Association. I would also like to speak in support of the Forestry Department's budget, House Bill 5030. Bart stole a lot of my thunder here, so I won't reiterate all the things that he said regarding the complete and coordinated fire system. We certainly appreciate the close working relationship the association has always had with the Department of Forestry. They do an excellent job of protecting our lands. However, the steady increasing costs without any increase in level of protection is very concerning to all of the landowners and the association. For instance, the other payroll expenses in this current budget in Northwest Oregon went from 44% to just shy of 59%. The government service charge increased something less than 300 or something more than 300%. Again, we very much appreciate the working relationship, and I just like to say that we are concerned about the ever increasing costs. The overall budget for Northwest went up 13% this year. So, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
The committee questions for Mr. Starker or Mr. Henderson? Senator Shields.
I did have one question, Bart. When you point out that other Western states are 100% general funded, is there less buy-in in those states in terms of protection? Do they pay a penalty for not having landowner involvement at the level we do? Has there ever been any study done of that?
Chair Morgan, Representative Shields, or Senator Shields, excuse me. I have very anecdotal kind of information about that, but what I see from our cohorts in those other states is they're not nearly as engaged in the system as we are, and we see it in their fire statistics that they have more bigger fires than we have here in Oregon. They've had the last long time. Hmm. And I think it's because of our participatory engaged ownership in the system that we have here in Oregon.
Or, Madam Chair, that those statistics have been kept somewhere. It'd be interesting to see those. You know, but not that it's you, but somebody here probably has.
I think they do exist.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, I'd like to recognize Mr. Starker for his 8 years on the Board of Forestry. I don't know how many years on ORWEB, Keep Oregon Green. It's been a family tradition, I think, for 40, 50 years in the. I think he's going to be doing it till he no longer can physically do it.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for sharing your time with us today. I'll call forward Dick Keeby and Rod Green.
It's Russian.
Good afternoon, Mr. Reedy. Would you like to begin?
Thank you very much, Chair Morgan and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak here. My name is Richard Beebe. I work for Roseburg Forest Products in the Roseburg area, and I'm a board of directors of the Douglas Forest Protective Association. I'm here today to speak about the advantages of the industrial fire prevention program that's a part of the, has been a part of the state forestry budget. It is out of the governor's budget this year, and I'm here to request that you add it back in. I'll try to summarize my written comments and make the time go along a little better. First, what I'd like to say is the industrial fire program is needed. Fires from logging operations are some of the most costly and damaging fires that we deal with. Before the program was started, we had quite a spate of fires. The program was initiated. The fire level went down, and so we know that at least at that point it was effective. It is still being exercised aggressively. On the Douglas Forest Protective Association area that I'm most familiar with, they made 533 inspections last year of logging operations. That's over four per day during fire season, and that's a heck of a lot of visits to fire season. And at that point, they met with the loggers, checked to see that their equipment was appropriate, and also made them aware of the risks and dangers of fire. As a result, they only burned a half of an acre on Douglas's protection area last year from operation fires. Another point is that it's a fair system. There are approximately 40,000 small woodlots in Oregon. Not all of those are being harvested. Some of them may never be, but there is a significant amount of harvest on them. They do not have professional foresters usually working for them. They hire a logger, however they find him. They may or may not be aware of the fire program. The industrial program is somewhat of a misnomer because it isn't just large industrial. It picks up small private. It picks up all harvesting things. And so we are covering everything with the industrial fire program when it's in place. Another point I'd like to make is that we're committed to it. I think all of the associations have had their meetings, and all the districts have committed to the industrial fire prevention program. So the landowners have put their share up, and now all that remains is for the state to put in its share as well. So we've committed to it, and we're ready, and hopefully that it can be added back in. There are several other benefits that the program gets by having the extra people around, not extra, that's not a good word at all, by having the industrial fire prevention foresters out there looking at things. First is the familiarity that they gain with the new roads that have been built in the logging systems. They're opened up, old roads that have been impassable for years may be opened, or new roads may be developed. So in the event of another fire that season, whether it's on the operation or a lightning strike on the ridge, they're familiar by their having to go to the fire to do their inspections or to the operation to do their inspections, they're able to see it. Another real advantage in familiarity is that they've met many of the operators. They go, they have a talk, they talk about what they need, they work with them. As you've heard probably ad nauseum, we have a complete and coordinated system. We count on the landowners and the operators to help us put out fires in Oregon when the need arises. By having this interface, it makes it much easier when we know the operator to call him and say, can you help us now with your equipment and crews? Another benefit is that it's part of the whole fire system. The district budgets cover basically initial attack, that we have a fire, they have the men and equipment to go put it out. They do a very good job, but occasionally a fire gets away and goes into an extended attack, and we need more supervision on those fires that's not available because the initial attack system still needs to be in place. Where we go to get some of that advanced supervision is to the stewardship foresters and the people that are doing the industrial fire inspections. They're interested in fire. They have a high level of training,
And one of the things we discovered last year as we were looking at the workforce capacity is that training, and you hear of retirements, there's less people trained in the ability to manage fires, and it takes a lot of training to do that. So these stewardship foresters that are doing industrial fire prevention mission are trained, and they're oftentimes the people we use on the extended attack. Another benefit is through the waiver system, and that's relatively complex. I don't really want to get into it, but simply it allows an operator to work under a fire closure if they can prove that their operation is fire safe. Through this close contact and communication, that allows the state to know what needs to be done to make it fire safe, has a relationship with the logger, and then he is able to sign that waiver. And that has some marvelous benefits from the standpoint of it keeps the fire crews out there, or not the fire crews, the logging crews out there. If we have a fire and we know this person's working, the crew's all right there, their equipment's there, we can call on them. We don't have to try and find them over on the Rogue River looking for some salmon. It gets us to the fire quicker, and that's a real handy opportunity. Another thing is that every day those logging crews are out there, they're pumping dollars into our economy. Timber is still a huge value to us, and by allowing those people to work, that does help the economy. Another thing, which is sort of the same as with the familiarity, when we're working with a logger, trying to provide them opportunities to work safely, but in a closed period, we develop a lot of goodwill. When we go to the operators and say, we have a real problem now, can we use your people? If we've cooperated with them, allowing them to conduct their business, again, safely, they are more willing to help us in our time of need in the complete and coordinated system. The fourth point is we are talking about stewardship foresters. One of their primary jobs is to administer the Forest Practice Act. The reductions in the budget, as I understand it, are 7 3/4 full-time equivalents, so functionally 8 people will be not looking at the Forest Practice Act as they go there. When a stewardship forester is going to make an industrial fire inspection and he sees anything out of line in regard to the Forest Practice Act, he instantly stops being an industrial fire prevention forester and becomes a stewardship forester administering our Oregon Forest Practice Act, which is critical. I mean, nobody wants us to fail on that. We do not want a black eye. And so these 8 people out of 57 that we're talking about is a huge reduction in our ability to have that resource there. I know it's a tough decision. Everybody's seeking money and everybody's project is more expensive, but I believe it's cost effective by having these people around to get to a fire quicker, that they'll be able to respond to the fires that do start and provide that extra level of protection. And also, fires are prevented. Those 533 contacts in Douglas District alone, somebody was more careful that day. Their equipment worked better. They stopped a fire, or they didn't have one happen. And so I just ask that you take this deeply into consideration and please, please consider restoring it to the governor's recommended budget.
Mr. Green.
Chairman Morgan and members of the committee, my name is Rod Green. I'm a logging manager for Lone Rock Timber Company. I'm a board member with Coos Forest Protective Association, a board member with Douglas Forest Protective Association. I sit on the Emergency Fire Cost Committee. This past year, I was a member of the steering committee of the Fire Program Review for the state of Oregon. I also sat on Chairman Morgan's subcommittee, the Budget Note 3 subcommittee. I supplied you with notes this morning and this afternoon. But as I was driving to Salem this morning, it occurred to me that as a citizen legislator, there are some things that I probably would like to know about the budget process for the Fire Protection Program for Oregon. And so, if you'll allow me, I jotted down 3 points that I think might be useful in your knowledge base as you're deliberating over budget issues. Number one, the budget has been scrutinized by some people who are very frugal and serious about the spending of money. The 11 state districts and the 3 association districts have board members who are landowners, ranchers. They are people who are frugal by nature. They take very seriously the spending of a dollar and expect a good return on it when they do spend it. The budget process has been followed by them. They're an integral part of it. And so as you receive budget recommendations from the State Forester's Office or through the Board of Forestry for the districts, you can rest assured that it's had some serious review at the board level, line by line. That would be reassuring to me. Number two, I guess I would wonder, well, is the program really efficient? We've heard that it's unique, and it is. It's known internationally because we can purchase catastrophic fire insurance where other agencies internationally have been unable to do that. So we have a fine track record that's recognized internationally. And it's due to the fine history that we've established that makes our losses more predictable so they can put a risk level on it and thereby furnish us with insurance. The fire program review took place over about 14 months. Looked at every facet of the program, probably more comprehensive than I thought should be expected, but it got accomplished. The recommendations from that group are now being implemented and will be part of the budget information that you receive and become part of the recommendations, and with more implementation to follow over the next several years. That comprehensive program made sure that we were not duplicating effort, made sure that we were making every effort to recognize opportunity of federal funding, made sure that we had in place those elements that would supply us with emergency services. So for point number two, is the program efficient? I'm confident it is. The third point that I would like to make is the previous legislature put in place Budget Note 3 subcommittee. It was to consider a number of elements that have to do with the revenue, where the revenue goes that's generated from fire protection. Are the people who are paying the revenue receiving the value out of their contribution? Is there a more efficient way to do it? Should we consider self-insurance as far as catastrophic fire protection or insurance? That subcommittee looked at every aspect of those questions. And in the process, we discovered we had a very good system, but there was some streamlining that we could do to make it a little more efficient and possibly to generate some opportunity to be a little more creative in what we were doing as far as initial attack and fire protection. And you will find those proposals as part and parcel of House Bill 2327. I hope as you have opportunity to review that, that you'll find that we did our job well and that that we have indeed found some new ways to look at innovative systems that might improve a system that's very good and make it even better. I think in summary, it's easy to identify the cheapest fire. That's the one we never have. So funding for prevention is number one. The second cheapest fire that we have is that fire that we catch when it's very small. That's part of the Oregon system, and that's why landowners are integrally made a part of the system so we can respond quickly. The third one, the one that gets large, is the one that none of us can afford and none of us want. And that's why it's essential for us to fund up front, as opposed to some other systems that wait and see what the total cost was and then throw money at it. We need to fund up front, and I would encourage you to consider adequate funding of the fire protection budget in all of its forms as they come before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Mr. Beattie and Mr. Green? Representative Krieger.
I just want to make a public record of it. I think everybody in this room is aware of it. But could you describe when your fire protected people, you know, Douglas and Coos, you go out to a log and show, what do they do when they get there? They don't just say hello and shake hands. They start up that pump. They look at the hose. They look at the equipment. They look at the power saws for screens. That is done every time they're there. And then could you tell these folks, for a public record, of what they do as far as training of those logging crews and the required update of training when that is mandatory?
Well, it's interesting in that anymore our logging crews are trained every year. In fact, it's a requirement that they receive a certain amount of training for fire every year. And within our organization and most of the Douglas and Coos districts, we expect them to be able to demonstrate that they can not only operate that equipment, but they can spray water in a certain amount of time on any corner of the unit. So it, rather than accept a statement that you must have this amount of equipment ready to go, we expect them to be able to perform. Probably another difference is you look at fires and you read about fires in the newspaper. The difference, I think, with the complete and coordinated system that Mr. Starker referred to is we put that fire out right where it's at. And the district managers say we keep 1 foot in the black. That means we don't drop back two ridges and backfire until it runs into the other fire. We meet the fire where it's at and we get it put out. It's kind of interesting. I know there's been some discussion that somehow the landowners have some significant benefit in this and that the general public doesn't. I worked up some numbers for Arbor Day down in Coos and Douglas counties. Let me just hit you with some numbers. These are fascinating to me. Since 1990, in other words, over the past 15 years, in Coos and Douglas counties, that's about 3 million acres. We planted 24,000 acres per year. If it costs $400 per acre, that's an investment of right at $10 million a year. Boy, you know, if we could suck an industry into our community and get them to invest $10 million, we'd say, wow, it's going on the hillside down there every year. Coos and Douglas County. Well, what's that mean? It means in 40 to 50 years, the yield will be right at 1 billion board feet. 1 billion board feet in Coos and Douglas counties. What's that mean revenue-wise? If we pay $500 stumpage on that, it's not in your notes, that's $477 million in log value being pumped into those economies every year. If we say that there's 10 jobs produced by that, that's 9,550 family wage jobs that are there as a result of what's being planted out there. So there's a heck of a lot of value to the people in our communities in southwestern Oregon. I'm just talking about two counties that happen statewide. And so we are protecting the future for our children and our grandchildren by having an adequate fire budget, and we're protecting the economy of the state. And we won't be dipping into the general fund. We'll do it because it's paid up front. So once again, I thank you for the opportunity to address you, and I think it's our obligation to make sure that we adequately fund the fire protection program.
Senator.
Just a quick comment. Thank you very much. And basically what you're contrasting is it's your fire protection program, your state's fire protection program, substantially different than the federal program. And basically the federal program burns and you guys put out the fires.
Chairman Morgan, Senator Nelson, I tried not to say that. But
I don't know why you tried not to say that. I mean, that's the truth.
Also, in the Fire Review Committee and the Budget Note 3 Committee, which I thank you so much for adding your expertise and your wisdom to, took a look at the issue that Senator Shields raised in how effective the program that Oregon has was compared to the states around us. And we did get some pretty compelling information there that the program that we have in Oregon is very successful at getting fires out when they're small. And the amount of acreage that's burned here on the privately owned lands and the lands that the state fights fire on is significantly less than in the surrounding states. We did also face the issue about the way that our federal partners fight fire on the land that they have jurisdiction over, and shared a great deal of consternation, not only about what they do on their lands, but the decisions that it forces the rest of us into because of those kinds of things. It was, I think, for me, an incredible opportunity to increase my knowledge about how the state deals with fire, and I was extremely impressed with what I learned. We truly do have a world-class firefighting effort here in the state of Oregon, and people come here from all over the world to study the way that we do this. Senator Nelson.
Yeah, I just struck another chord there. I think your testimony on the economic value is quite significant also. I take the Great Falls Tribune online, Montana. I used to live there a long time ago. They had a $300 million surplus this year. We're here arguing over $5 or $10 million for your fire fund. Their May 1st budget forecast says now they have an additional $154 million. I think they get theirs probably from coal and oil, but they're probably not doing the timber. But the fact remains that, and they don't have a sales tax. I'm sorry, Frank, they don't have a sales tax. They have just an income tax. But the fact is that we're not using our natural resources to the benefit of our public good. If we were able to get into the federal forests and harvest those things on a state basis, could you give me an opinion as to what would be a reasonable amount that the industry would dedicate to public schools if we were able to get in there and do that? I mean, you know, on a board foot basis or 1,000 board foot or however you want to put it. Am I putting you on the spot again? Yeah.
Boy, you really know how to put a guy on the spot.
Yes. Tough question. Yeah. Chairman Morgan, Senator Nelson, those numbers are so great that I don't know that I could give you anything that would be that meaningful, but as we look at the harvest off from public land, and this includes state public as well, the revenue generation potential is just about beyond belief. It's of great concern to many of us who've been part of the industry to see the decline in the harvest on public land when really it's not necessary in order to protect some of the resources that are often discussed in the media. And the potential benefit to our communities and our schools and our infrastructure, all those things that I'm sure are making budget requests, is I don't know that you can put a pencil to it, but I can tell you, for instance, on the Umpqua National Forest, at the start of the 90s, the late 80s, we were probably at harvest levels of 350 million feet, and we're probably at harvest levels of 15 to 20 million feet now. As someone mentioned, virtually all of the resource, our raw materials, just about is coming off from private ground right now. Fortunately, the growing sites that we have been capable of keeping our business, our foot in the door. But we're close to markets. We have the resource. We have the knowledge. We have the mills. We have the workforce. We just need the raw material. And
And I think it should be noted, too, that in Mr. Green's testimony, when he was talking about the number of family wage jobs that were created by the reforestation and harvesting cycle in Coos and Douglas counties, that those people that are in those jobs are sending their tax revenues to us to fund our education system and our human services system and our public safety system. And the point, I think, needs to continually be reiterated that more than half the land in this state is owned by the federal government, and that land is making virtually no contribution at this point to the economy of the state of Oregon. And it is a huge underutilized resource for us to provide services to the children and the elderly and the vulnerable and keep the streets safe in the state. And with that, gentlemen, I am going to get in trouble if I don't move further down this list. So again, thank you so much for taking your time and sharing your wisdom with us today. And I'll call forward Tim Josie and Mike Barnes. Mr. Josie, nice to see you again. You spend a lot of time on the road traveling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's indeed a pleasure to see you again and the rest of you. My comments will be relatively short because I understand that the primary purpose for my being here today is to really talk about funding the positions that the department needs to keep their program viable in lieu of the adoption of the Forest Management Plan. And I've heard through the grapevine that's going to happen, and so I can just go home, right? I'll just be real brief. First of all, I want to thank you for supporting the department with the positions as dearly needed, and also the support for the Interpretive Center, the positions that will be delivering the message. And you all heard me when you were in Tillamook, and so I won't go into that. That issue, as you know, is very near and dear to me. Today, I'm representing the Forest Trustland counties, and I'm the chair of the Forest Trustlands Advisory Committee and Tillamook County Commissioner, and of course, Tim Josie. We've been very actively involved working with the department on a number of issues as we continue to move down this path of structure-based management. Trust counties deeded these lands to the state years ago in a trust-like agreement, and then the Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry has a fiduciary responsibility to manage these lands on our behalf. And so, naturally, we're very concerned how they do that. And the Forest Trust Lands Advisory Committee meets on a regular basis, and our meetings coincide with the Board of Forestry meetings. And just I'll talk about three issues that we've been very actively involved in. First one, of course, is the harvest and habitat model, and I'll get back to that because there are some preliminary numbers, and I'll conclude my comments with those numbers. I was on the policy team. Another county commissioner from Tillamook County was on the technical team. And so we've been working with the department on that issue. Salmon anchor habitat, that issue, there was a work group. I was not on that, but couple of the other county commissioners were. And so we still have some issues regarding that, and I addressed the Board of Forestry about that. So I won't spend any more time on that. We also have a subcommittee of FTLAC working on the habitat conservation plan. We want to know whether it makes good business sense to have a habitat conservation plan or whether we continue with tank avoidance. We're not there yet. Still working through that process. Now, I will finish my comments by talking just briefly about the modeling numbers. I cannot speak to you officially what the Trust County's position is because we haven't met yet. Tomorrow, I will again be in Salem, but I'll be chairing the Trust Land Committee, and we will be talking about the new preliminary numbers. So I can only really speak for myself, and I think I can speak for them also in saying that certainly we're disappointed. We think the numbers are too low, and but the message that we want that I gave to the Board of Forestry and that I would like to deliver to you is that these numbers are still preliminary. There is still some more modeling that needs to be done. The model number, the modeling that I'm really concerned or that I'm really interested in is the timber emphasis model. So we can have something to compare it to. And once we have that information and we're more firm with our assumptions, we can turn certain knobs and we can determine what's going to burn, what actually has reduced the cut to this level that we consider to be so dismal. And so we can look at the habitat conservation plan. We can look at the extra protections in our riparian areas that the forest management plan is providing us. The salmon anchor habitat is another knob that we want to turn on and off. And so when we get to that point, and it's going to be later in this year when we get to that point, then I think we will be armed with the knowledge to sit down and talk amongst ourselves and have a good sound policy discussion about what are the values out there that we can afford to protect other than timber production, whether the social and environmental values. And we're not there yet, but I will finish by saying certainly we're disappointed with the numbers.
Mr. Barnes.
My name, Chairman Morgan and members of the committee, my name is Mike Barnes. I'm currently serving as the president of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. It's a statewide organization that represents some 2,500 family forest owners in the state of Oregon. I'm a forest owner myself, own land in Washington County, Yamhill County, but just as importantly, and more importantly, I'm the father of five grown children who have lived on, worked on, and played in our family forest lands for these number of years. Family forest owners have a variety of reasons for owning their lands, and their experience levels are as varied as the individuals themselves. Many landowners have a very limited knowledge and look for advice and guidance from other individuals, particularly from the stewardship foresters, in developing management plans or conducting harvest activities. OSWA as an organization views adequate funding for the Landowner Assistance and Administration of the Forest Practices Act as essential in maintaining a viable family forest entity in this state. And we've seen the numbers with some recommended reductions. And we've seen some numbers relative to the age groups of the stewardship foresters, as they're called now. Our expertise, the level of expertise, is probably diminishing with those retirements. So even though the numbers might not be reduced significantly, our level of expertise is being reduced. Those old-timers are retiring, and those are the ones that really have all the abundance of information and education and experience. As an organization, we fully support the Department of Forestry in their efforts to assist family forest landowners and would encourage however we can that they be adequately funded, that the number of positions be seriously considered when you are considering reducing those numbers. Also, we fully support the fire portion as well, but we've heard considerable testimony in that regard already. You know, this week, a couple of days ago, I got a call from a lady, a landowner in Washington County, new landowner, one of the new ones, and they own 20 acres. So where can I get guidance relative to harvest activities? And she was particularly concerned with fire safing or fire protection. That level of expertise needs to come or should come from the Department of Forestry. And the stewardship foresters are usually the first line of visibility as far as any professional people that these landowners see or reach. ODF should be capable of providing that one-on-one role, and to do so, the agency must be adequately funded. The governor's office, the legislature, and the Board of Forestry must recognize the value of family forest owners in the state and maintain or develop programs and processes that recognize that importance. As an organization, OSWA looks to the Department of Forestry to set the tone for forestry in this state. And we would encourage the Department and the Board of Forestry to ensure that the role of family forest owners is recognized as an essential element in establishing future programs. And we ask that our voice continue to be respected and to be heard as small woodland owners and our contributions that we make to this state. Thank you.
Questions or comments for Mr. Josie or Mr. Barnes? Gentlemen, thank you. Call forward a panel of Ray Wilkinson, Dave Ivanoff, and Bob Reagan.
Hand the ball off. I'm Ray Wilkinson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I'd just like to introduce these other two gentlemen. And then if I could, when they finish, I could have about a minute to kind of wrap up. With me today is Dave Ivanoff, Vice President of Hampton Affiliates, one of the state's leading forest products companies, and also Bob Reagan, who's the Executive Director of the Douglas Timber Operators in Roseburg. And we are all going to be talking today about the Department of State Forest Management Program.
Ray, can you move the microphone closer so we can get you on the public record? Use this against you in the future.
Okay. Ray Wilkinson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. So I'll turn it over to Dave, if I could, and we'll start. All three of us will be speaking specifically to the department's State Forest Management Program today.
Thank you. Mr. Ivanoff.
Good afternoon, Chair Morgan and members of the committee. My name is Dave Ivanoff. I'm the Vice President of Resources for Hampton Affiliates, and we have sawmills in Willamette and Tillamook, and we have just under 700 Oregon-based employees. I would like to give you my perspective about the current forest management plan and the state of the industry from my standpoint. As you may or may not know, the Department of Forestry is operating under a forest management plan that was approved in January of 2001 that was the culmination of a seven-year process involving a lot of people. I was involved in the development of that plan right from its inception in 1994. The Board of Forestry approved that forest management plan, and the board assumed that the implementation strategy would reflect the policy choices and assumptions embodied in an alternative called Alternative 1 Option C2. Basically, that alternative stated that the first decadal outputs on an annual basis would be about 279 million board feet. In June of 2001, and subsequently to that in March of 2003, initial and final implementation plans were developed. And to our dismay, in March of 2003, Acting Forester Roy Wu approved the final implementation plans at 179 million feet a year, which was the mid-range output, and that was 100 million feet short of what we were led to believe we were going to be seeing going forward. That led to the introduction of House Bill 3632 by Representative Lane Shetterly in his role as Revenue Committee Chairman in the House to try to figure out a way that we could achieve higher sustainable harvest levels to support Oregon's economy and the infrastructure. Also in July of 2003, there was a legislative budget note that instructed the Department of Forestry to operate at the upper end of the implementation plan range while a harvest and habitat model was being developed that was theoretically designed to predict more accurate outputs going forward. And the department has been operating at that level for this last fiscal year. Last Friday at the Board of Forestry meeting, the initial run of this new harvest and habitat model was rolled out by the department. and it suggests that the mid-range outputs for this forest management plan with the policy choices that are embodied within that plan is 159 million feet. I guess I'd like to address some issues as I see it from this H&H predicted output. The 159 million feet is about 57% of what we were led to believe and the counties were led to believe at the time we endorsed the forest management plan. And I can't say it any more clearly. This level of harvest is simply unacceptable, in my view, for the citizens of this state. It's really important to recognize on these 500,000 acres that are in the northwest corner of the state, the annual growth on that land base, in my view, is at least 400 million feet a year and probably close to 500 million feet a year. In testimony in front of Senator Shields' committee in April of 2003, in written testimony, the department said that the biologically sustainable harvest level on this land base is 493 million feet a year. At 159 million feet a year is what this current model says we should be doing. Over 60% of the annual growth will not be harvested. Over 60% will not be harvested. Turning to what that means to this state in terms of lost revenue, if we operate at the H&H output of 159 compared to the 279 that we thought we were going to be getting, that's an annual reduction based on current stumpage values of almost $44 million a year. As it relates to what is the opportunity cost of structure-based management, and it's in its simplest form, structure-based management is uneven age management with the desire of carrying about 50% of the land base in older age classes on extended rotations. Based on my handout, you can see the opportunity cost of this state is about $88 million a year. At the board meeting, the department or the board emphasized the need over the next 3 or 4 months to evaluate the policy choices and assumptions in the forest management plan, and I suspect some of those policies they may be taking a look at is the need for extended rotations on 50% of the land base, the imposition of riparian and aquatic strategies that go far beyond the standards of the Forest Practice Act without the scientific justification to do so, the need for a salmon anchor habitat strategy, which is another layer of protection on the land base in light of the strong coho returns we've had over the last 2 or 3 years, and finally the need to enter into an onerous HCP that will lock in strategies for a 50-year period of time. I want to say categorically that we support the Board of Forestry's effort to review these policy choices, and we intend to work collaboratively with the board going forward to hopefully come up with appropriate revisions to the plan. I'd like to talk just for very briefly about some Board of Forestry issues. At the meeting last Friday, a person testifying on behalf of Audubon Society and other environmental organizations stated that the board lacked a conservation value or perspective. In my view, this is a continuation of the unwarranted criticism of the Board of Forestry. I think it does a disservice to the citizens of this state. These board members, seven of which were appointed by Governors Kitzhaber and Kulongowski, have demonstrated, in my view, to be very thorough and professional in the conduct of their business. I just want to turn now to some facts relative to the industry in this state. And it's becoming apparent to me, I've been saying this for a period of time, but we've got a train wreck coming to, that the industry is facing. Many people have believed that we have adjusted to the downturn in federal outputs in this state, but the reality is Oregon's forest products industry, especially on the west side, has been living off a supply for the last 10 years that has originated in the state of Washington and British Columbia. We have not adjusted to the downturn in federal outputs. But what's happening in the state of Washington is new capacity has come online in the last couple of years that it has begun to intercept that volume that has flowed into Oregon to keep our mills running. And there's additional capacity that's currently under construction right now and on the drawing board that will be online in 2 years' time. And in my view, that when that capacity's online, the flow of Washington logs to support Oregon mills is going to go away. That's going to lead to an inevitable downsizing of the industry and a loss of infrastructure. What's that going to mean to this state? We're going to outsource forest product sector jobs to Washington and British Columbia and other regions. We're going to exacerbate the conversion of forest land to non-forest uses because private forest landowners will not have the mill capacity to sell their logs to, and without those outlets for their raw material, there's going to be a disincentive from an economic standpoint to practice forestry. We're going to continue the economic and social stress on our rural timber-dependent communities. This is going to exacerbate Oregon's struggle to achieve prosperity and widen the gap that exists between urban and rural Oregon. Forest health will deteriorate without the infrastructure both in manufacturing and in harvesting technology to capture that distressed or dead timber when catastrophic events occur on our land base. And outputs from both state and federal lands are vitally important to Oregon's forest product sector, our schools, and our economy. I think it's really important to recognize that much of the timber that exists on these three districts in northwest Oregon are the product of a massive reforestation effort that was undertaken after the devastating fires of the Tillamook burn era. The purpose of that reforestation effort was to restore the productivity of these lands to provide abundant timber outputs and revenue flow to the citizens of the affected trust counties and their school districts. Current management strategies fail to achieve the full measure of the intended benefit of that reforestation effort. As a state, we constantly struggle to find the revenue to support our vital public services, including K-12 and higher education funding. The announcements in the Oregonian in the last couple of weeks of the layoff of the school teachers, I was here testifying along with a lot of other people in support of the Forest Research Lab and other programs in higher education that, if adequately funded, will have a great payback and will help restore Oregon's way of life. And in summary, Oregon has an abundance of underutilized natural resource wealth on our public forest lands that can be sustainably managed with much higher timber outputs to provide healthy forest ecosystems, a vibrant economy, and the revenue stream to support Oregon's way of life and our schools. The one thing that I've struggled with is the perception that this is just an issue that affects Hampton affiliates in northwest Oregon. But the reality is this timber supply, we're in a regional wood basket, and the effects of what transpires in one region will have profound impacts on other regions. And because of that, I'd like to introduce Bob Reagan. But before I do, I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, I cannot overemphasize the sense of urgency that I feel around the need to do something about harvest levels from our public lands, both state and federal. I work for a company that was, for 20 years, that was a casualty of the unwarranted shutdown of our federal timber sale program. I saw rural communities in eastern Oregon, Wasco County, citizens' lives unraveled, and I made a commitment then and there that I was never going to be passive on this again. We know how to grow and harvest wood fiber and take care of the environment, and I don't believe that we should ever walk away from that proud heritage we have in this state. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bob.
Chairman Morgan, members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. I'm here as executive director of Douglas Timber Operators, which is a regional trade association in Roseburg. It was founded in 1968 and was pooled resources by the companies in that area to put together a radio system for our woods operations for fire fighting purposes as well as for safety of our workers. Today we are an advocacy group for active forest management on all ownerships. We have 140 members in forest products and allied industries in Lane, Coos, and Douglas counties. Our members employ over 6,000 workers in family wage jobs in 24 separate manufacturing facilities with an annual headwood capacity of over 1 billion board feet per year. The 4th Congressional District, which we are a part of, is the largest single producer of forest products in the United States. My comments here are to emphasize the importance that the Tillamook Forest plays to our region of the state. Approximately 20% of my members' log needs today are being imported from the states of Washington, Alaska, and the province of British Columbia. Every day of the week, 30 truckloads of logs travel I-5 hauling logs from southwest Washington down to south of Eugene to my members. Every day, the railroad delivers from Washington and British Columbia another 30 carloads of logs, which would equal 90 log truck loads.
Further, every month, barge loads of logs from British Columbia and Alaska are towed into Coos Bay, and the logs are then hauled to my members' mills. Timber produced by the Tillamook Forest contributes to this regional wood basket that my members need to survive on. Since we are at the tail end of the supply chain, we will be the first to suffer if the timber production of the Tillamook is curtailed. Likewise, if the Tillamook can produce, as envisioned by the Oregon Department of Forestry, the entire west side of Oregon will benefit. Finally, I'd like to share with you the letter that I have passed out earlier to you. It was a letter I wrote a few weeks ago to Jim Azumano, the new Director of Office of Rural Policy for the Governor. It was related to a roundtable we had in Roseburg concerning issues that affected rural Oregon. And the point of the letter was a comment made by, first of all, by one of our county commissioners, Doug Robertson, as he was leaving the meeting early, telling Jim that rural Oregon was very concerned about the governor's nomination of Les Alcoin to the Board of Forestry for a whole host of reasons. And Jim responded that what the governor was trying to do was balance the board. Quite frankly, we have been balanced to the edge of extinction. I want to share with you the graphs that are attached to this letter. And they represent the timber harvest predictions and actual accomplishments of the Northwest Forest Plan. It was adopted by the President Clinton in 1994. The top line is the projected timber sale levels from this balanced plan. The line that follows underneath it is what actually was accomplished. And then finally, the final page shows the cumulative deficit of what that plan projected versus what has been accomplished. And that cumulative deficit is 6.7 billion board feet. That's the amount of timber that's harvested, double the amount of timber harvested in Oregon in 2004. My point was that this was intended to be balanced, and after 10 years of balance, we still haven't accomplished it. And when we try to balance the Board of Forestry, we need an advocate in Salem. We don't need any more balance. We're almost balanced out of it. Until federal forests start producing, as my colleague Dave has mentioned to you, rural Oregon will continue to be the poor stepchild, and our state will never achieve balanced economic prosperity. Places like Burns, Prineville, and Oak Ridge, and I lived in two of those communities for some time, used to support thousands of family wage jobs in our industry. Today, the mills are gone, and the jobs are gone. The forests are still there. Sue Schaefer, chairperson of the Cow Creek Tribe of Indians, recently said in a public forum, "We don't need more taxes. We need more taxpayers. Our industry can provide them if the timber is made available." Thank you.
Mr. Wilkes.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to wrap up briefly by kind of reviewing where we are procedurally with this issue. As you know, last session the legislature considered a bill that would have increased timber harvest on these forests. This session there is no such legislation. In our view, that was a prudent thing to do because we were waiting for the Department of Forestry to do this modeling. We now have the first output from that model, and it kind of confirms our worst fears that the current management plan, unless something has changed, is not going to produce anywhere near the level that all of us expected when they adopted the plan 4 years ago. So procedurally, absent legislation to directly intervene in this issue, the decision-making goes to the State Board of Forestry. They, this fall, in October, will have all of the data from the modeling project before them. And then they will be faced with a very, very politically tough decision about what to do about it. They will have a management plan in front of them that they inherited from the previous board that has been shown to be inadequate to achieve the harvest levels that the previous board thought were going to happen. Whatever they do is going to be controversial. Whatever they do is going to be subject to intense criticism. As Dave indicated, it's very, very unfortunate because of this appointment controversy that this current board has been unjustly maligned and their commitment to the public interest has been challenged in a way that's totally unfair and unjustified. So they're in a tough spot under very difficult conditions, but it's their job. They have the authority and they have the responsibility of making decisions about the management of these lands. And frankly, they could use all of our support, no matter what they do. So anything the legislature
legislature can do to show their support and appreciation for this board and indicate that the criticism they've received is not justified, I'm sure they would very much appreciate it as they go forward this fall with some tough decisions. So we appreciate your time.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Mr. Wilkerson, Mr. Ivanoff, or Mr. Reagan? Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. I've been trying real hard to keep quiet. I know we're running out of time. But you know what? I'll tell you. I when I come into this building, all I knew was about forestry is what I read in the paper and love walking around in it and stuff like that. But, you know, when we're sitting here scrimping and scraping around and cleaning out the cushions and looking for every single penny, and we have abundant, we shouldn't import a stick of lumber into this state. We should be kicking it out. And the very same good-hearted, well-intended people that, in my opinion, want to close down the forestry industry in Oregon, they will never say that, but that's what I think their goal is, and they're damn near there, frequently are the very same nice people that come here and ask for more money for schools, health care, and safety. And there's just a real huge disconnect. And you know what? In my opinion, this is just irresponsible. It's negligence. It's criminal. And I'll tell you, you got my support. I've made that clear many times before. But I'm Madam Chair, I'm just vexed with this. And it isn't just lumber. It's gravel. It's water use. It's hydropower. It's building industry in Oregon. It's creating the jobs that are going to generate the revenue to pay for all this stuff that I want to do. And we can do it in an economically and environmentally safe way. And I know you're all out there doing it right now. And these folks that are against it, I challenge them to go out. I was on Roseburg's property last year. Go out and look what they're doing out there. I mean, but I don't think that's going to happen. I'm sorry, I'll get off my soapbox, but I'm very frustrated, Madam Chair. Very frustrated.
The answer is yes.
Any other comments or questions? Senator Shields.
Yes. Mr. Ivanoff, you referred to the meeting of my committee 2 years ago, and you stated the predictions of the Department of Forestry then. How could they be so far off, in your opinion?
Senator Shields, Chair Morgan, early on, I've been a forester for almost 33 years now. Early on, I had reservations about the concept of structure-based management and what the economic impact of that strategy would be to the state. It was very frustrating. I would venture to say that from 1994 till probably the year 2000, we pleaded, could we see an economic analysis of this management strategy? But staff, key planning staff, told me privately, Dave, this strategy will allow us to produce at the levels consistent with traditional even-age management. Now, I said, okay, if you guys can deliver on that, then I will support it. But everything I know and understand about managing forests, there is no way in the world that they could ever deliver on that. And I was very, very outspoken in public testimony and written testimony that I had deep reservations about it. But to the extent the department can deliver on what they say they're going to do, we will support this plan. And I guess the bottom line for me is that, you know, we went through a long 7-year process of well-intentioned people of differing perspectives coming to the table. And ultimately, you know, my expectation level was we were going to see outputs of 279 million feet a year. That is far, far short of what these lands are capable of producing on an annual basis. But to the extent we agreed on a compromise, I today, if we could achieve that level of harvest going forward, there would be no stronger supporter of the department's management plan if we achieve that harvest level. But anything short of that, in my view, is not living up to the spirit of the compromise that was the foundation of this plan.
Thank you. I realize I should be asking other people that question, but I wanted to give you a chance.
And Senator, if I could just editorialize, to follow up on what Representative Shoffler said, you know, I just struggle when we sit here as a state and a society trying to figure out how we're going to educate our kids, how we're going to keep criminals in our prison system, and we have an extraordinary abundance of wealth out there that we, you know, we don't even have to harvest the growth to, you know, just even two-thirds of the growth or three-fourths of the growth, and we can add structure over time, and we can generate so much revenue that will benefit this state. It's almost like we're an impoverished region, and we don't have to be, and that's what's so hard for me to understand.
I use the analogy that we drive through miles and miles and miles of trees trying to figure out how to make a living.
Dave, I think we can say I told you so. If you recall, I was on the board exactly during that time, and Dick Baldwin, I questioned very deeply, with some reservations, as you said, about the need for an HCP and whether that would actually cost us more, and what the real value was going to be. And when we did, Dr. Sessions did the runs, and I said, I don't think, if you've got all these things in place, ESA, you've got these anchor habitat ID at that time, and we haven't talked about the high-risk sites, that you'll ever get to the numbers. And then short time later, guess what? We didn't get to the numbers, and this last information we got even makes it look worse. But I can recall, and I want to make a public record of the fact, that on three occasions, the last was January 3rd of 2001, 5 days before I was sworn in here, I appeared before the board for the last time on board, and I mentioned the fact that on three occasions, I had asked Dr. Logan Norris from the Independent Multiple Disciplinary Science Team to show me a document that told me we needed to increase the riparian zones. Oh, yeah, I'll get it for you. I still haven't seen it. You know why? It doesn't exist. I take great offense with it. I will not support the multidisciplinary science team ever. Not one penny.
Chair Morgan, if I could just, I meant to mention.
If you would, Mr. Ivanhoff, we're kind of under the gun here.
There's two attachments that I've attached, an article from Random Links that was reprinted with permission from that firm, and a letter to the editor in the Eugene Register Guard, which is just additional affirmation of what hopefully I've been able to communicate to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Call forward Marianne Guest and Dave Moskowitz and also Rex Storm. Let's please begin. You got Mr. Moskowitz to begin?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz with the Wild Salmon Center in Portland, Oregon. I'm here with Marianne Guest. And it's been very interesting to be listening to the testimony today, coming to testify on the department's budget. We were kind of focused on fire because there's a pretty big issue with House Bill 2327 that we're concerned about. But the conversation today, it's kind of changed my focus. I think I will start by focusing on the fire because that was an important part. It's an important part of the budget. The industry has asked for a cost shift for fire protection funds, and the reasons given when this bill passed out of the House committee earlier this year was that this land provides public benefits to fish and wildlife, clean water, and recreation access.
Excuse me, we have not posted that bill for public testimony, so I need to have you confine your comments to either the budget itself or to the fee bill relating to pile burns.
Okay. Thank you. Well, there's certainly plenty to talk about. I guess I could start by saying that it's nice to be able to support Tim Josie, Commissioner Josie from Tillamook County, about the budget, ODF budget for the Forest Center and for the staff members that ODF needs to carry out the Forest Management Plan. So we're in agreement with Commissioner Josie, which is nice to be occasionally. However, it was disappointing to hear the critique about the forest management plan from Mr. Ivanhoff, and we haven't really been in agreement about the forest management plan from the other side of the table for quite some time. He called it the level of harvest unacceptable and gave a price tag of $44 million lost and lost stumpage fees for the state. And that the policy choices that the department took on riparian protections, long-term rotations, had no basis in science. And believe he's wrong about that. The science about riparian protections and what they bring for fish and wildlife are clear, and I can provide you with some science, Representative Krieger, about that, and I'd be happy to do so.
If you could submit it to our committee or our analyst, I'm sure she would take care of distributing it to the members of the committee.
Be pleased to do that. I think I want to talk about the benefits of standing forests, because we've heard a lot about the benefits of trees on their side, which actually have benefits as well. The Oregon Forest Resources Institute did an economic study that was released in 2004. It was written by Eric Hovey. And in that report, he stated that the economic value of standing trees likely outweighs the value of cut timber. However, he could not provide a dollar figure. But that statement you will find repeated in economic reports again and again. Absolutely.
If that is a true statement, then why are we in the economic depression that we're in right now?
I'm going to take a stab at answering that, though I'm not an economist. There's been a lot of testimony today about the effects of federal regulations that shut down federal lands and what that's done to the economy. And what has not been mentioned by the industry are changes in the industry that have occurred over the past decade. The spotted owl and the environmentalists get blamed again and again, and soon it's going to be the fishermen or people that like salmon who are going to be blamed for problems with the timber industry. The timber industry is a changing industry. The cutting of trees on private lands and public lands in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was not done at a sustainable level. And the result of that were lots of resource damage and an inventory of forests that was very low. The mills that existed in every little town that were made to cut big trees simply ran out of trees, and the mills went away. If you go up to the Olympic Peninsula, you will see abandoned mill after abandoned mill, and you will also see no big trees except in a national park. The industry, not the entire industry, but a lot of the industry, cut its way out of the big trees, and the mills changed. The amount of capacity coming out of the mills of Hampton affiliates, and their Willamina and Timber and Tillamook mills, has increased and increased over time. And it's because of technology. And the small trees that are being cut in the forests in western Oregon today are of small diameter. It doesn't take a whole team of loggers to harvest these trees. Two folks can get in their pickup truck and drive to a site where there's one machine that cuts the trees down, takes the limbs off, and loads them on the truck. And then they drive back home. Okay? Many jobs were lost.
Sir, I really want to get this clear because it's really important to me. Are you here suggesting today that advances in technology and mechanization are the reasons for the downturn in the timber industry and their output? Is that what you're suggesting here?
They're actually, it's in jobs. The output of the timber industry, the amount of timber that's been harvested is actually going up. The profits of these companies are also going up. What's been affected are jobs.
I follow up, Madam Chair. And on top of that, that the incredible amount of restrictions and laws and rules that we've applied in this state, some very good and I support, by the way, that have to do with the environment and the Endangered Species Act, that had absolutely nothing to do with the downturn in the timber industry here in the state of Oregon. Is that what I'm hearing?
If that's what you heard, that I am not suggesting that those bear no relationship. But the fact that the change in the industry and the change in the forest, the actual types of trees that are there, and how many people it takes to cut them down, how many people it takes to operate a mill, a modern mill in this day and age, those things have changed, and those are not necessary result of environmental restrictions.
Mr. Moskowitz, if I could interject, we are getting very close to the time when we have to adjourn this hearing. So if you could move your testimony along, I'd much appreciate it.
May I ask how much more time I have, please?
2 minutes.
I think that as a person, as an organization that has been very involved in the Tillamook State Forest, Tillamook and Clatsop of State Forest Management Plan, I will say that we also put in a lot of time in that plan and that we were not necessarily in agreement and had a lot of skepticism about structure-based management. We were also deeply involved in Measure 34, which was soundly defeated at the polls last November. Since that time, there's been a lot of discussion, and I've heard actually Mr. Ivanhoff and others say that they totally support the department's plan. And indeed, what Measure 34 did was kind of rally everybody around the department's plan. But it's interesting that the minute it doesn't produce the kind of outputs of cut trees, that it's under attack. It's going to be a very interesting year, I believe, for the Department of Forestry in that regard. And somewhat unfortunate, because I think there was a lot of meetings of the mind. I sat on the Salmon Anchor Habitat Work Group along with Mr. Wilkinson, Commissioner Paul Hanneman, Commissioner John Griffin, County Commissioner Helen Westbrook, and we heard from experts on all matters around salmon protection. There was not agreement on our report, but we did generate a lot of sound scientific evidence to support the kind of riparian protections that are on the Tillamook State Forest. One of the reasons that the habitat and harvest model is showing such low numbers is because, one of the reasons is because of Swiss needle cast, which is a tree disease that is endemic in the North Coast. But what happened after the Tillamook burn, the trees that were planted, replanted in the Tillamook, they are from the Cascade Range, and they're not resistant to Swiss needle cast. So the foresters made a mistake and planted trees that weren't adopted to the site. Those trees are suffering from Swiss needle cast. They're not growing at the rate that everybody thought.
Can you summarize, please?
The Wild Salmon Center supports a great deal of the Department of Forestry's budget. We believe that they need to have their monitoring staff fully funded, because what they're doing, they're trying to learn from their actions on the state forest, and we support that, and we'll submit additional testimony in writing. Thank you for the opportunity.
Ms. Guest.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mary Ann Guest representing the Wild Salmon Center. I'll keep my comments to the budget. Unfortunately, I think what you're seeing is a reaction to Mr. Ivanhoff brought up a lot of different issues, and you know, about the Board of Forestry and the harvest level cut and a lot of things that we would like to talk about, but I'll keep my comments specifically to the budget. We support ODF's budget, and we support their request for additional permanent positions in research and monitoring, additional biologists. We know that the adaptive, the structure-based management is an adaptive program, and it needs to be monitored to make sure it is doing its job to protect important habitat. We also would support increased in recreation spending for the Department of Forestry, and especially you've got the Tillamook State Forest and the Clatsop State Forest. This represents 3% of all the forest land in Oregon. There needs to be more recreation available. It's right next to the largest metropolitan area in the Northwest, and I think more recreation is warranted. The more people come to the forest, the more opportunity and economic opportunity it brings to the rural community in that area. We support maintaining the Tillamook Interpretive Center within ODF's budget. I've heard that's been debated back and forth, and we think that if ODF were to operate it, it would have it would be better for providing information, education to the public about forest products and also habitat protection. We support full funding of Measure 66. We 15% of the lottery is dedicated to parks and salmon, approximately $78 million total for what goes to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I know that is not in this committee today, but there is money that is being taken from the Pacific, what's it called?
Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Fund.
Right. That is being taken in backfilling for Forest Practices Act administration functions in ODF, and we'd like to see full funding of Measure 66 and not see the money siphoned off. I think there are other places you can look. Currently, the Forest Products Harvest Tax is a place that you could look to for revenue to use in that to fully fund the Forest Practices Act. We've got some problems with the Forest Practices Act. The DEQ and some of the other national agencies, federal agencies, have said that our forests are not protecting the water quality of our rivers. And there are some serious problems, and there needs to be increased monitoring. There needs to be increased attention spent to that area. Thank you.
Mr. Storm.
Chair Morgan, subcommittee members, my name is Rex Storm. I'm with Associated Oregon Loggers here in Salem, and I'm a forest policy manager. I'm here today primarily to address House Bill 1530 and our support of the Department of Forestry's budget. But primarily, I'd like to urge you to restore the industrial fire program funding. And I support the restoring this for three reasons. First, the prevention program and staff provided by the Department of Forestry has proven to be very effective.
Mr. Storm, could you get the microphone closer to you so we can pick you up?
Sure. The prevention programs and staff for the industrial fire program have traditionally proven to be very effective towards preventing fire ignition and extinguishing fire starts before they escape. Secondly, this program leverages greater and more effective response by forest contractors and landowners to prevent and fight fires. Industrial fire program, the prevention program, is a value-added program that leverages greater cooperation between private and the state agencies in cooperating to prevent wildfire escapes. Lastly, industrial fire is not a bureaucracy. It's putting effective people on the ground, doing the needed firefighting and fast response for proven fire suppression. So we support reinstituting the industrial fire program for the department. The second point I have, and I'll be real quick on my last couple points, is I'd like to urge to all of you the importance of the Department of Forestry's private and community forest program funding to retain stewardship foresters in the program, to retain the level of funding and effectiveness of their stewardship forester program. The governor's budget, if you will, reduces the department by 9 FTEs, and we would see that as a negative thing for the department's budget, that the funding level necessary for the private community forest program proposed by the department is what is needed. Finally, my last point I would like to urge you to today is that I support the comments by the panel before me today of Mr. Wilkinson, Ivanoff, and Reagan. We at Associated Oregon Loggers also are concerned that the Northwest Oregon State Forest harvest and habitat model underreports harvestable opportunities. We feel that the Northwest Oregon State Forests are at a crossroads today, leading toward divergent futures, and we would support the more productive road be taken for the Northwest Oregon State Forest. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions or comments for this panel? Thank you very much for sharing your time with us today. And I have no one else that signed up to give public testimony, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 1530, and we will adjourn this committee.